Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport, then this is the podcast for you. Today, I'm with James King, Senior Lecturer in Exercise Physiology at Loughborough University, and we're here to talk about exercise and weight management. Hi, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Martin.
So today we're going to talk about exercise and weight management. And I think we're going to start off with looking at what the role of physical activity is in preventing weight gain. So can you just enlighten us?
Yeah, of course. So obviously talking about physical activity for preventing weight gain, I think the first thing to say is that the reason why we're doing that is because when we talk about exercise and weight management, we always divide kind of the research and the narrative up into three parts. So firstly, looking at physical activity for preventing weight gain. Then a different matter is looking at physical activity for actually helping weight loss. And then on top of that, the use of physical activity in helping to maintain reduced weight loss after being successful at causing weight loss. And that's because the individuals involved and their situation is very different. So with regard specifically to preventing weight gain, we're talking about individuals who perhaps have a relatively healthy body weight to begin with. And the key question that we're asking is whether being more active on a regular basis will help people to prevent gaining weight, potentially over a number of certainly weeks, but if not months and years. And I think the first thing to say is that there's actually been probably over 20 years of research that has actually looked at this question. So there's lots and lots of observational research from cohort studies and from cross-sectional studies that have examined whether those people who are more active on a regular basis, do they tend to maintain a more healthy body weight compared to individuals who are not active on a regular basis? And the kind of the general consensus of all of this research that's available is yes, that if you are active regularly, you are more likely, because we're talking about statistical probabilities with observational research, so you are more likely to maintain a healthier body weight and therefore accumulate less excess body fat over time if you're active on a regular basis. And when when the American College of Sports Medicine looks at all of this research and quite some time now published a position stand, they suggest that individuals really need to be active for up to sort of 30 to 50 minutes per day for at least 5 days a week. So the key point there is you'll probably realise that amount, so 30 to 50 minutes 5 days a week, is actually more than what is necessary within the recommendations for improving overall health, which is obviously 30 minutes on 5 days a week or 150 minutes across the 5 days. And that's just really boils down to the fact that we know when we look at energy balance, that it's actually quite hard work to expend a significant amount of energy through movement. It's much easier to affect energy balance by changing what we eat than it is to going out there and doing exercise.
So with what you've just alluded to a little bit there, do many of these studies take that into consideration, as in the what we eat side, or a lot of these studies just looking at physical activity?
So these particular studies, these observational studies that I talked about, in those trials, they can statistically sort of adjust for diet. So they can try and isolate the impact of physical activity on BMI or body mass or whatever the outcome is. Like I said, by using statistics that would try and account for changes in diet. But as anybody who knows epidemiology quite well, it's sometimes quite difficult to appropriately adjust for all of the important confounders. And we know from lifestyle research in general that it's incredibly hard to actually measure diet accurately. Because as soon as you try and measure somebody's diet, then they change what they habitually eat. So actually getting a good outcome of diet to statistically adjust for and isolate the impact of exercise is incredibly challenging. So we don't know ultimately within these studies where they think they're talking about physical activity or exercise on its own. We don't really know how well they've adjusted for diet. And it could be that individuals who are more active also have a better diet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to a little bit. So I suppose that, you know, what we're looking at here is how much does physical activity, you know, make a difference to weight gain? And from observational analysis, what you're saying is that those people who do more appear to not gain as much weight.
Yeah, and there's some really nice studies coming out now. So obviously anybody in the exercise sphere knows that within the last at least 5 years, maybe even up to 10 years, we've had the arrival of various objective monitoring devices. So rather than relying on kind of self-reported questionnaires, which are obviously prone to error creeping in, we can now stick accelerometers on people and get a very good, accurate measurement of habitual physical activity. So in the last sort of 5 years or so, there's been lots of research come out now that it's actually got a very detailed handle of people's physical activity and use that as the basis of looking at the relationship between exercise and sort of weight related traits. And you know, that evidence has given us a bit more precision within our knowledge around this area.
And when you talk about physical activity, are any of these studies looking at the different types of physical activity?
Not so much so within the epidemiology. So within sort of looking at, because we're ultimately with weight gain, we're talking about changes over time. So this is very much epidemiology. The question you asked there about modes of exercise, there's more kind of research with regards to weight loss, where we're talking about experimental interventions. So we know... Well, firstly, within that, we know that actually it's the exercise volume and energy expenditure which is really important for the purpose of inducing weight loss. But just on a practical level, we know that obviously if you're doing exercise that is weight bearing, that is involving more of the large skeletal muscle groups, you know, is it for longer duration, is aerobic in nature, these are the sorts of modes of physical activity that will burn more energy. And ultimately, the net impact upon energy balance is determined by what an individual does in each individual episode or individual bout of exercise that accumulates over the course of weeks and months. So we do know there are types of exercise. If you want to maximise how much energy you burn, some types of exercise will be better than others.
But you're saying that volume is the kind of key thing here and those recommendations you made earlier.
Yeah, because in the talk I gave last week for the COVID special series, I gave a similar talk around physical activity and weight management. Somebody asked me about the role of intensity and how important is it that exercise is intense, specifically for the purpose of weight loss. And the answer to that is that intensity isn't really that important. It's the total volume and linked to that closely, the energy expenditure that is burnt within a sort of a formal exercise intervention. So it doesn't matter if you run 10K in an hour or if you run it in half an hour. For all intents and purposes, you're going to burn roughly the same amount of energy. It just means that if you run it in half an hour, you'll complete the distance in a shorter amount of time.
Yeah, so you've got more time for yourself, which is where trends in high intensity stuff have kind of come in. A lot.
Yeah. If you had an hour to play with and you ran for that full hour, if you ran for the full hour at 6 minute marling versus 12 minute marling, you'll obviously go further. And in that situation, you'd burn more energy. Did you see what I mean? If you flip it on its head and you use time as the constant, then you would burn more energy in that scenario. But you obviously have to be, it's where fitness comes in, you have to be fit to work at such an intensity. And that's where, certainly when we deal with clinical populations or individuals with obesity, some of these individuals haven't been active since they were children, effectively at school. And they've got such a low level of sort of aerobic fitness, they actually can't work at high intensity. And therefore, the rate of energy expenditure they can maintain is very low. And that then means that ultimately the amount of energy they burn in a bout of exercise is also very low, and therefore doesn't have a huge impact on energy balance. So that's where a key difficulty lies.
That's a really, really interesting and kind of key point around that. And that kind of brings on a little bit to how physical activity can help weight loss. So can you just expand on that a little bit, what you just said?
Yeah, so it's a really good one. And it's a nice, I kind of talk at length about this with some of my undergraduates in my module. And we make a clear distinction between efficacy and effectiveness when we talk about the role of physical activity for actually causing weight loss. So we say that physical activity has good efficacy, which means that under tightly controlled ideal circumstances, doing exercise can burn energy and ultimately will cause weight loss if everything is controlled. However, in real life, we don't live under controlled circumstances. So unlike in a clinical trial where you've got, you know, all of the best equipment available, you've got people supervising your sessions, you've got people taking part who are motivated because they want to take part in research, under those ideal circumstances, they can lose clinically relevant weight across the course of, say, 12 weeks. However, in real life, you know, Joe Blogs on the street doesn't have all of these structures and support mechanisms around them. Therefore, when they start to do exercise, it's quite likely that, as an example, they may compensate in various different ways. So it could be that they relax their diet because they're getting a little bit hungrier. They might reward themselves because they psychologically feel as though they've worked hard. They can perhaps, you know, have an extra glass of wine in the evening or something like that. They might even become more sedentary outside of their formal exercise. So instead of maybe walking to the shop, they jump in the car, and that the effect of changing that behavior has then kind of narrowed the energy deficit that they had created. So there are all sorts of compensatory mechanisms that mean in real life, people don't really, or kind of exercise isn't as effective as what it should be. So that's the difference between efficacy, the ideal circumstance, versus effectiveness, the real life scenario.
I think it's a really, really valid point. I mentioned to you previously, I've done a lot of coaching in personal training, strength and conditioning kind of world. And, you know, this trend probably over the last 10 years of high intensity training and needing to redline it and kill yourself every session, you know, for weight loss, I think massively results in people just lying in bed all day the next day because they're in, you know, they're in agony. Yeah. And, you know, the long-term effects of it are actually go for a walk. I know I stole some slides from you regarding some of your lectures, and I think there's one here that talks about, you know, a 30-minute walk at 3 miles per hour for a 91-kilogram person expends 159 calories. And then a 30-minute jog at 4 miles an hour is 210 calories. Yeah. So going for a walk, going for a jog, you were talking about clinically acceptable kind of weight loss. Well, that isn't going to induce any difference, really, is it? What is that 50-calorie difference?
No. I mean, there's a few separate issues there. The first one about HIIT, that's a big bugbear of mine because, we were doing HIIT research when it was really popular going back at least 5 or more years ago now. And there was lots of research published. Initially, you know, when it first started, the research around HIIT, people were sort of jumping on the bandwagon, and there were some quite poorly designed or poorly controlled studies, like without control groups and things like that. So you were seeing things where people were doing 2 weeks of HIIT, but without a control group. So you basically have the situation where you get motivated individuals come to your lab. You measure them, and a lot of people were measuring things like waist circumference, which is very subjective. They do 2 weeks of exercise under supervision with you, and miraculously you get to the end and they've lost half a stone, and their waist circumference has come down 5 centimeters. Well, that's not due to high intensity, low volume exercise, which has burnt not a lot of energy. That's because motivated individuals have come to your lab. They've got excited about lifestyle intervention and have decided to change their diet in addition to everything that you've been giving them. So when this research first started coming about, there was lots of reports, people saying, oh, you know, do HIIT, it will make fat melt off the body and all of this. And actually it was just some poor quality evidence that was coming out. And as a physiologist, when you look at HIIT can be really good for improving metabolic health. Particularly if you're looking at things like glucose regulation, it's very potent at improving insulin sensitivity and glucose control. But doing 20 second bouts of maximal exercise 2 to 4 times per session is not going to burn a lot of energy and isn't going to contribute to certainly clinically relevant weight loss. And like you said as well, it could mean that people have slightly stiffer muscles and perhaps don't want to do as much exercise the next day as well. But that's one of the key points with regards to particularly HIIT. The other issue you mentioned there in terms of the actual energy that was burnt from those individual sessions. I think we talked about the example of someone was burning around 160 calories or just over 200 calories. When you frame that in terms of particularly somebody with obesity who could be eating anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 calories a day, you know, that 200 calories there is very, very small as a contrast. And you know, if you compare that to, you know, various food items, you know, what's 100, 60 calories is a couple of biscuits probably. So, you know, you can eat two biscuits in about 20 seconds, yet it's going to take that individual an hour and 10 or something to burn it off. So, you know, in terms of impact on energy balance, that's a good example of where you can see that it's very easy to manipulate energy balance through diet more so than it is through physical activity.
I'm going to ask you some questions just to kind of entice you into something here. So what's your thoughts on two of the key things that go out there in the media, like afterburn and the fat burning zone?
So the afterburn, so this idea of, we call it excess EPOC, excess post-exercise oxygen consumption. So that's the idea that individuals continue to burn energy because of a lift in metabolism induced by exercise. This, again, is something that's been looked at a lot over maybe 30 to 40 years. Again, there's been lots of issues with differences in study design and things like that, and it's created quite a clouded picture. But I think it's fair to say actually now that more recently we're starting to see, with improved methods able to measure this factor, that actually the afterburn is actually very, very small. So we did a study that was led by a PhD student of mine who's now working for Nuffield Health called Ben Kelly, and he examined people for about 14 hours after exercise. So these were incredibly long lab days where people did different types of exercise, and they also did a control day where they just rested all day in the lab. And we measured effectively oxygen consumption continuously throughout the day, and saw that even after people had done, I think it was about an hour protocol of hard intervals, even with that, the increase in metabolism compared to the control day was something like 14 calories. So very, very small amount. And I can remember at the time there was a paper published from, I can't remember who was lead author now, but from America. And they'd used one of these calorimeter chambers, where essentially you're in a small room and it's measuring your metabolism continuously. And I think people were in the chamber for 24 hours. And they reported an EPOC of something like 140 to 160 calories. But when you looked at the detail of the method, they actually fed individuals on the exercise trial more food to account for the energy they'd burnt. So essentially what you were seeing was an increase in diet-induced thermogenesis. So the metabolism was going up to digest the extra food that had been consumed. And that was what was giving this illusion that the kind of this EPOC was increasing, when actually it wasn't really. So the main message, I think, and I picked up a review paper recently on the issue, and again, they concluded that the reality is that the afterburn is very small.
But the media message is you do some HIIT training and it lasts for 3 days. You know, it's 72 hours. That's what's in the media, isn't it?
Yeah, but like I said, the only reason I come to the conclusion that I come to is going away and scrutinising the academic papers. And without trying to sound pompous, that comes from my experience of understanding the methods that are involved and being able to tease apart a research paper in a critical fashion. You know, some of the journalists, perhaps, who are writing about this sort of thing, did their degree in English or English and history or something like that. They haven't done a degree in anything related to exercise science, or certainly, you know, research based like we would do. So they don't perhaps have the skills to make the judgments. So it's a difficult one, because we obviously need these individuals to communicate the research. But there, I think at times there's a bit of a gap between the experts within the method and those people reporting it. And I kind of think, I know a few people have suggested that individuals within the exercise sphere need to be a bit more vocal. And there are some of our colleagues now, I mean, people like Jason Gill gets involved with the media quite a lot with regards to anything related to diabetes and metabolic disease. But perhaps there needs to be more of a step forwards and kind of be at the forefront pushing these methods out, just like you see Brian Cox doing the same thing for physics.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Good shout. There you go. Get on it.
Well, you need to be better looking than I am.
That's why we're doing a podcast. I'm talking about myself, straight, not you. So what about the fat burning zone?
So that's another good one. So the whole thing with the fat burning zone is that quite often, again, within the media, you'll read that, you know, you need to work at sort of low to moderate intensities where fat metabolism is at its highest. And in a sense, that's true, because To burn fat, we need lots of oxygen, and we're able to get more oxygen in to the places where we need it, i.e. within the muscles, when we are working at lower exercise intensities. And, you know, for a while now, we've known, Asker Ukendrop has done lots of work that has shown that around sort of 65% of VO2 max or maximum aerobic sort of capacity, that is where we burn the most fat in a relative sense, or certainly in comparison to carbohydrate metabolism. However, when it comes to energy balance, like we said at the beginning, it comes down to the total energy expenditure. So it's not as important really during exercise what you're burning. It's the actual total amount of energy that is burned, whether that comes from carbohydrate or fat. Because if you're only working at say 50% of your VO2 max compared to say 75%, you're actually burning a lot less energy anyway in the first place. So it's more important to work at a higher intensity and get that total increase in energy expenditure higher than it is to worry too much about what you're actually burning during exercise.
So all them zones that are on those cardio machines, just ignore them and do what you can do. So we've touched upon preventing weight gain. We've looked a little bit at inducing weight loss. What about keeping weight off, kind of weight loss maintenance, as people may call it?
Yeah, so that's, again, a really important one. So weight loss maintenance within sort of clinical circles is probably the one remaining sticking point. So, you know, there's been a lot of research relating to obesity for a long time now. And actually, there are lots of even commercial programs out there that can support people to lose weight, particularly, you know, in the short term. People can lose weight if you're really motivated and you follow lots of these commercial diet plans now. People can lose weight. The problem is that it takes a lot of motivation to keep the weight off. And that's difficult because you've got millions of years of evolutionary biology that is wanting you to put the weight back on again. So the body doesn't like negative energy balance and it doesn't like weight loss. And essentially, when people lose weight, there are well-described physiological mechanisms that promote people to put the weight back on again. And that's ultimately why we see in a practical sense, but also within lots of research, that the vast majority of people who lose weight, certainly significant or even clinical amounts of weight lost, put that weight back on again within 12 months, and most actually put a bit more on as well. So weight loss maintenance is almost like the last bastion. And there was an article in The Lancet a couple of years ago when a couple of doctors were suggesting that we should actually think of individuals who've lost weight as having obesity in remission, similar to how we think about alcoholics who have, who are sober, because it doesn't just go away. The physiology is very different, and there's this continuous drive in the background. And people kind of almost suggest that actually, with regards to obesity and eating behaviour, it's perhaps even more difficult to give it up long term. So eating too much in comparison to say smoking or alcohol, because we all have to eat a certain amount of food each day. Whereas if you're talking about alcohol or smoking or drugs, you can actually just completely stop and not go near them. Whereas that you can't do that with food. So weight loss maintenance is really, really difficult. With regards to the evidence around physical activity, there's lots of observational evidence, because this is a question about measuring or monitoring people over time. And there's lots of observational evidence that does suggest, yes, those individuals who are more active on a regular basis are more likely, in a statistical sense, to maintain more of their weight loss if they are active on a regular basis. But there are quite a lot of issues with the evidence. So we don't have a gold standard randomized controlled trial, which has randomized people to different levels of physical activity once everybody has got to the same level of weight loss. So there are some randomized trials, but they randomize people at the beginning, which confound the interpretation of the question. So the randomized trials aren't very good. And then, like we've said with the observational evidence before, it could be that people who are more active also maintain a better diet after their weight loss. So nuts and bolts is that there's lots of problems with the evidence, but the evidence together suggests that physical activity can be of benefit, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I was just thinking we need to kind of clarify everything. So essentially what we're saying is that physical activity is good in preventing weight gain. It's probably good in inducing weight loss to a level, and for weight loss maintenance. And taking it back to the energy in, energy out, and this is the energy out side of things, and if you keep it up, great. It sounds like for all three of those, stick to the recommendations that you mentioned before. And what I wanted to ask is, so physical activity is good. How does it affect things like COVID? Because we are in COVID at the moment, and other diseases, viruses, other problems. What is the effect of physical activity specifically on any of those things?
So, I mean, with regards to, I mean, I gave a talk last week again on COVID-19 and obesity, which there's lots of observational evidence that started to pour out since around March time that's found very clear links between obesity and having a higher risk of going into hospital, going into intensive care and needing a ventilator, and also dying. So certainly going to hospital and going into ICU, there's at least a doubling of risk, particularly for individuals with BMIs over 35 or certainly over 40. So obviously, with regards to a lifestyle change, now is probably quite a good time to think about maybe being a bit more active, or, you know, looking at your diet if COVID-19 is possibly going to linger around, you know, without a vaccine for a considerable amount of time. And there've been numerous people, even the Prime Minister seems to have began to focus on this issue a bit more now. And as you know, it seems as though there's going to be more money poured into research and practice around, certainly around policy for combating obesity. So I think there's going to be more emphasis now on trying to tackle obesity as a public health issue. So with regards to that, yes, physical activity can help people, maybe improve their body composition now, but even if people don't lose weight, when they do exercise, they will improve their metabolic health. And again, when I looked at this, when I set my talk up the other week, you know, just as obesity is important, we know that diabetes is important, as an example. So having really uncontrolled diabetes increases the risk of going into hospital and going into ICU. So lots of these metabolic risk factors are important for COVID and would be improved if individuals, you know, took part in exercise on a regular basis. So lots of reasons why being active now could be quite useful.
Definitely. And in terms of other health-related illnesses, I mean, there's association with the lack of physical activity with many other illnesses. Have you got any specific examples of any, or recommendations around them?
Yeah, so lots and lots and lots of, you know, a lot of these chronic diseases are obesity related, or obesity, we call them obesity related diseases. Perhaps one of the most well studied is diabetes, and it's where I do a lot of my research. Particularly, I do a lot of work looking at how diabetes connects to chronic liver disease, so excessive fat that builds up within the liver. But all sorts like cancer, we're learning more and more about cancer and how being active on a regular basis can prevent several different types of cancer. On top of that, heart disease, you know, we've known for years and years, going back to the 60s, maybe even the 50s with Professor Jeremy Morris. People probably know the familiar bus driver, bus conductor studies, where we saw essentially a halving of risk of having heart disease and various cardiac complications in the most kind of in those active bus conductors versus the bus drivers. And that's been backed up with decades now of experimental research that's shown that all types of cardiovascular problems can be, the risk of those can be improved by being active on a regular basis. So heart disease, diabetes, chronic liver disease, cancer, they're probably your major ones. But, you know, pretty much, it might be going a bit too far, but pretty much any sort of long-term condition that we know of, there's probably some sort of evidence to suggest that being active is, you know, going to be beneficial in one way, shape or another. The other ones, obviously, I haven't mentioned there is mental health. There's more and more research relating to exercise and mental health, and there's certainly more colleagues within our school who are in a better position to talk about that one than myself.
And again, so lots of these podcasts, we've talked about nutrition, we've talked about physical activity, and good bringing in the mental health, because I think lots of people know that physical activity is good for them. They know that they should be eating things. You know, if you put food in front of people, they know what they should be eating, but they just can't do it. They don't do the physical activity. So it's nice to bring the psychology side, and I think we'll have other podcasts related around that, you know, at another date. So just to kind of finish off, really, going back to what you've said before, what would you provide as your recommendations? What would your leaving comment be around physical activity and its health benefits? And then what would your recommendations be for physical activity for everyone in, you know, volume and intensity? Can be broad.
So, I mean, just in terms of physical activity generally for health, I think the main message, which is kind of borne out in the guidelines now, is just be active as much as you can. So be active every day, try and find activity where you can, look to see where you can build it into your regular routine. I think it's fair to say everybody lives very busy lives these days, and, you know, finding 30 minutes or an hour to fit in a structured form of exercise is very difficult for people, particularly those of working age with children. So, you know, most people have got to think creatively about where they can fit their physical activity in. You know, we also know that if you can do stuff at more higher intensity, you're going to get more benefit. That's undeniable. But equally, there's, you know, lots of colleagues now who do research around sedentary behaviour. And, you know, everybody in our building has got a standing desk. So even kind of reducing the amount of time that you spend sat down on your bum is going to be good for you, particularly individuals who perhaps have lower levels of fitness and more metabolic problems, more so than those who are really fit and sort of healthy already. So just look to reduce the amount of time you spend sitting down, increase the amount of movement you do wherever you can, whether that's active travel, whether it's a walking meeting, whatever you can do, it is going to be beneficial for you. In terms of sort of times and guidelines, I mean, ultimately, you know, there's no point in me providing new guidelines, because experts and panels of scientists look at these every 5 or 6 years or so and sit down and create the guidelines through government structures. And it was only last year was the most recent update of our UK physical activity guidelines. And again, they kind of came to the same conclusion that for overall health, we're talking about 150 minutes per week, which is moderate to vigorous physical activity. But again, they suggested that if you can do more intense activity, you can perhaps do a little bit less. So you can do, say, 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, but equally just being active more whenever you can is also important. But the key point for this, I guess, this podcast is that if you're talking about weight management, that all the guidelines around exercise for weight management suggest that you need to do more than those recommendations that I've just sort of mentioned there. So, you know, certainly for inducing weight loss, you know, the guidelines suggest that people need to be doing around about an hour pretty much on most days of the week to induce clinically relevant weight loss. And again, that can be very difficult, because doing an hour of exercise, for one, it's not easy to find the time. It's not easy for individuals to stay motivated. It's just ultimately very difficult. So my recommendation around that would be, you wouldn't go at it just with exercise on its own. You know, most people can't outrun a bad diet. So if you are looking to lose weight, you're talking about an overall lifestyle change where, yes, exercise is important, but, you know, you've got to pay attention to your diet as well. Otherwise, you could potentially undo the good work that you are doing.
Thanks to James King for providing us with some research-based evidence and advice around exercise and weight management. If you want to hear more of our podcasts, then please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, and other major podcast providers. Bye for now. See you next time.